time now for Oh, the Humanities, taking a look at humanities scholarship research and events on the UNC campus. And we are joined now, as always, by Max Orr, who heads up the Carolina Public Humanities on campus. Humanities.unc.edu is their website. Max, good to have you with us, and happy Thanksgiving. How are you?
Happy Thanksgiving. What a joy it is to be here. It's the beginning of the holiday season. I mercifully have not heard a bunch of holiday music yet. I understand it's out there.
Yes.
Apparently, there are certain stations that are going to be flipping over permanently for a little bit, you know, to the holiday music. But mercifully, I have heard nothing yet.
That's good. The day after Halloween, Brad suggested that we play All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey on November 1st, as soon as we got the opportunity. We nixed that idea, but it's a good idea.
I have heard the strains of Jingle Bell Rock from my 7th grade daughter's violin. I have a feeling that'll be the part of the holiday season concert.
The concert,
that's okay. I don't think that counts. It's the joyful sound of my daughter's violin is different than the, you know, the 19th time I hear it on the radio.
That's also practice. That doesn't count. It's not the same as
we're talking
turning in
practice.
The radio. Practice.
We're talking about practice here. It doesn't count.
See, we do all that press conference is never going to get old.
No, exactly. I'm glad that we can work on multiple levels here.
Yeah.
This is good for us.
That was an Allen Iverson joke for those of you who have no idea what we're talking about right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. Allen Iverson, the famous humanist basketball player.
Yeah.
Aaron, I have presents for you. This is a good one. On 1863, today is November 19th, of course, and on 1863, guess what happened?
Gettysburg Address.
That is right.
I saw that earlier today.
Oh,
yes.
I'm sorry to bring you a used gift, a repackaged gift, if you will. But of course, this is what I would call a solemn moment in public humanities, where someone can put together such a brief and deep reflection that also is, in fact, a dialogue with the nation and a dialogue that continues. So what I find to be a moment of sort of how the humanities in one moment can just sort of crystallize everything that's important about that particular moment and then give us something that carries on.
Yeah. And not just giving us the speech, but also giving us the tools that we can use to understand the speech. Because I've read about the Gettysburg Address and how Lincoln uses kind of the same tropes of Pericles' funeral oration in Athens, and he goes all the way back and very consciously, like, appropriating a lot of those messages and tropes and lines and that you can pull from funeral speeches and patriotic speeches throughout human history, and he pulls from all of that. So his ability to pull from that and our ability to use that knowledge to understand, like, it all works together.
It's a meta-humanities conversation we're having, because here we have this incredible skill of Abraham Lincoln to very concisely put together, how many words is it?
200-some.
I don't remember the exact, but a very small number of words, and we just have probably made reference to hundreds of thousands of words that have been written about the Gettysburg Address and the hundreds and thousands of words that inspired the Gettysburg Address, and so everything really just shows a sort of interesting ecosystem. That's a word I'm going to come back to in a moment. It's also, I bring you a birthday, and this one reminds me a little bit of you, and you're going to say, oh, Max. It's Larry King's birthday.
Oh, Max.
Well, you know, it's Larry King is, as you know, a decade, six-plus decades in the industry, started in radio, a legend in New York before he became a legend nationally. And, of course, just anybody who is a legend is going to have their imitators and is also going to have their detractors. And certainly plenty of impersonations over the years. But happy birthday, Larry King, born in 1933. And so you might be wondering what this is all about. Normally these have something to do with it. And I often bring you a guest, Aaron. And something else happened in 1863. And it's related directly to the Gettysburg Address. President Lincoln declared that November 26th of that year would be the first celebration of Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a moment of thanks to you for having Oh, the Humanities on the air now for over a year, I have turned the tables, and you are the special guest, and I'm going to ask you a little bit about the public humanities and your work, because we went to recently, I was at the National Humanities Conference in New Orleans, and this word ecosystem was discussed about the humanities, and that graduate students are going to have to be exposed to the ecosystem of the humanities, which starts, frankly, from the stories that were read as children all the way up through our K through 12 education, through, of course, our college education, through our jobs that we have, where we're engaging in stories, we're engaging in in analytical thinking and deep reflection, and also, of course, spreading laterally throughout the whole community. Our libraries, our museums, of course, our arts councils. And you are in a really particularly interesting place because you come from the academic tradition mm-hmm. yourself, you are a teacher, and you also have this incredible forum of public engagement with a lot of sectors of society. So I'm going to ask you a simple question.
Okay.
Did you know that you are a public humanist?
Yes. Yeah, I did. You just mentioned I have an academic background. I went to grad school for 7 years at Rutgers. I have a PhD. And one of the really occasional moments of frustration in the academic world is just how, and I think this has changed and is changing, but this was certainly the case 15 years ago, how rarely academics think about speaking to the general public outside their own bubbles and circles. Like, people who are in academia, they're concerned about publishing, but they're concerned about publishing in academic journals and with presses that don't generally get read by more than 50 people, and 49 of those 50 people look at the abstracts. And
that might be generous, yeah.
Yes, that might be generous, right. And I had that moment of frustration, and I wanted to find a way to speak to a larger audience. And this is not something that's taught in graduate school, and I don't think it's taught in graduate school even today, like how to speak to a larger audience. So, I mean, I stumbled into this job backwards, falling down a hole that I didn't realize was there, and I came out with this amazing opportunity to host this show. But yeah, very consciously trying to speak humanities to as many people as possible. And the really cool thing about this job is the ability to speak to a larger audience than you might otherwise be able to if you're just publishing an article mm-hmm. in a less, or even a well-known but not well-read journal, or speaking at a conference or something like yeah. that.
You're a translator, too, in a way, in that you're taking information that is, some people think it's esoteric, or some people can't quite connect the dots mm-hmm. as to how this affects. And in your particular position, because you're engaging with the public and you have somebody coming on here, it might be last week we had Mark Crescenzi coming on talking about what was so amazing is how we could turn that into, are you listener out there, how is this, maybe esoteric
exactly,
idea
yeah.
about quantifying reputation and world politics? How does this affect the way we should look at the news? How does this affect the way we should maybe think about policy decisions ourselves?
Yeah.
And that's definitely that translational work that you're doing.
Taking a look at translation itself, right? Like how should we be reading the news in the first place? Not just we interpret the news stories that we get mm-hmm. through this lens of reputation, but the news that is produced in a particular way by particular people for particular reasons with particular interests. And we need to understand the people and the words mm-hmm. and the interests in order to understand not just the news story, but what other news stories could have been written that weren't written because this is the one that got produced.
Exactly. This sort of editorial, what are we looking at, and what does it mean that we look at this while we don't look at this?
Exactly.
You said something really interesting about, how things might have changed since you were in graduate school, and I think there is something changing, but what it is a question about how do we do this. Mm-hmm. I mentioned I've been already this year two conferences on the humanities, and there are whole panels with discussions about, a lot of graduate students are going to end up with PhDs in the social sciences and in the humanities and will not find at least the same type of steady work that they're being trained to do, right?
Yes.
This, you are going to write these monographs that we're talking about and you're going to teach and you're going to get tenure in an institution. So there are many of these sessions at these particular conferences talking about rethinking what the humanities PhD is going to do for these students, and that's where this language about the ecosystem comes up and saying what we really should be doing is making people aware that, history, just for one example, lives outside of an academic discipline. You have, of course, History Matters here, where you bring in a public historian who comes on and talks about all of the various history that's just around us all the time, and you don't need to find that in the academy. And so one of the things I'd like to ask you about is, how do you see the relationship between sort of public humanities work outside of the academy, where, you know, we come in every once in a while, and what the academy is doing? I think there's somewhat of a disconnect at times, and also a synergy.
There might be something of a disconnect. I think the academy is an absolutely essential component of public humanities in general, because this is the opportunity, and this is the connection now that I'm making. We talk about representative government. And when I teach American government, why do we have representative democracy as opposed to direct democracy? Well, one of the problems with direct democracy is that we, as ordinary individuals, we've got jobs, we've got lives, we've got kids and families and hobbies and interests, and we don't have the time or the money or the energy or the inclination to do the work that needs to be done to be 100% informed on every single issue that we need to be informed on if we're going to be informed decisions, so or make an informed decision. So we hire people, we hire representatives, and we make it their full-time job to be informed voters, so that when the time comes to make a decision on this or that issue, those people can step forward and make informed decisions. And I think the academy kind of serves the same purpose that representatives do in a democracy, that the academy is the opportunity that so few of us have to devote your life to studying this stuff, to not just read and to experience, but also to read with a critical eye and experience from not just your own perspective, but to get perspectives from others, and to have the opportunity to study in graduate school or in the academy in general, and to really delve into that is just such a rare chance for so few people. And the ability to take that rare opportunity and then to go out and translate that into knowledge that ordinary people don't necessarily ever have access to, let alone have, I think is profoundly important, because we can read novels, we can go to museums, we can hear concerts, but to be able to have that critical perspective is something that it requires kind of a privileged perspective in order to fully do. And that, I think, is what the academy does. That, I think, is one of the things that the academy does.
You know, it's a really interesting analogy you have there between representative democracy and what the role of the academy serves in the humanities. And I think it does sort of stress why the public humanities are so important in both cases.
Yes.
Because, you know, we need that humanistic ability to listen and to have this relationship with our representatives, by which we can have this sort of feedback loop where they understand our needs, they communicate to us. These are all humanities skills, right?
Yes.
They communicate to us what it is they're going to do. We communicate with them what our desires are, and that has to work well,
yeah,
right?
And both sides have to be committed to having an open channel, which is part of the humanities,
too. So that feedback loop is there for the representative democracy, and I would like to suggest that we also have to have that sort of feedback loop with the humanities, right? We need to be able to, so this is why if an academic is just going to focus on the old way of doing things, that's the analogy, is that's a representative who's not holding a town hall meeting often enough.
Yes.
And is not aware of what the culture is doing. And that's why I think one of the challenges of public humanities programs, as we see it, is that you're going to be catering to a certain clientele that wants a particular, you know, they're very comfortable topics because those are the easy things for us to do, is to focus on what we're experts on. And I love what you're doing, is that you can have all of these various experts who are in this other parts of the ecosystem, the libraries, the museums, the public historians, the politicians themselves are all part of this ecosystem. And I'm just jealous of what you're able to do.
I'm jealous of what I'm able to do. I'm jealous what I have the opportunity to do, right? It's a question of coming in here and actually making it work on a day-to-day level. And I suppose the test of whether this is working is do we have more listeners now than we did 12 minutes ago when we started this conversation?
Well,
if we lost everyone, then we need to.
Let me ask you a lighter question. How about I know you've been involved in theater before, and you've done work in improv. How do you see the arts and your own engagement? I'm not sure if you're doing a lot of that now, but your own engagement in that aspect of your life as part of the public humanities world that you live in.
The thing that you learn in improv when you're starting to train in improv comedy for the first time is the basic principle of yes-anding, which is whatever someone says to you, as you know, like two people are on stage, there's no props, there's no set, there's no dialogue or script, you've got nothing. nothing. You're going on stage with nothing and you're making it all up. And the only way that works is whatever someone says to you, you have to accept it as true and then add on to it. And that's the only way that a scene gets built. And that is something that you can take with you into just about every conversation and every human interaction, that whenever someone says something to you, rather than pushing back and saying no and butting heads, you don't necessarily agree 100% with what they're saying, but you accept what they're saying and then you give them something back, so that rather than pushing and pulling, you're building onto each other. And that is such a helpful and functional way of interacting with people. You can make, you can build things so much faster and so much easier if you just have that mentality in mind from the get-go. So, I don't know if that just answered your question.
It does. It does very much.
That's the improv-specific answer.
I have two responses. Yeah. One is to try to do the improv trick where I'm just going to go, no, to say no, but then I'm actually going to...
You get a very quick laugh, and then the scene ends.
But then
the
I'm going to say yes and, yes, and say, could you imagine if political debates worked on the principle of yes
I've
and?
I've seen it happen. Several years ago, a county commissioner race, so this was in an even numbered year, 2012 or 2014, I can't remember off the top of my head. We had two county commissioner debates. This is in the primary because it's Orange County, everyone's a Democrat. Two county commissioner debates, two people running against each other here, two people running against each other here. The first debate that we had, and this was in studio, so just two people walking in and sitting by the microphones like we're doing and just having an informal forum with each other, was a half an hour of just nightmarish, awkward, just a snipe fest for 30 minutes, and it was just the most horrible thing. And then 2 days later, the other two candidates who are also running against each other for this other position come in, they sit down, and by the time the half an hour was done, I was ready to just throw every other commissioner off the county and just like, let's just lock the two of you in a room for a couple of hours and you'll figure everything out together, because they were willing to speak to each other and build on each other. And I will say that those two people are now on the Board of County Commissioners. So it did work out. One of them had to win and one of them had to lose that election.
It makes a difference.
They did end up both making it on eventually.
Did they actually get out of the closet that you put them in to say, you two should go in? Yeah, like, yes, and they jumped in the closet.
Yes,
and then,
yeah.
They actually went to the city, to the county commissioner meeting.
We've got to wrap up, unfortunately.
Well, it's all about you. How can we stop talking about you, Aaron?
Well, we've got to go to CBS at some point. All we've got a hometown hero to celebrate.
Well, listen, I want to just say we have one more event coming up. We are almost sold out of Crisis of Liberal Democracy on December 1st. It is a really obviously it's not as happy as the conversation we're having today, but all over the world democracy is on the ropes, if you will. So we'll be looking at that in four different talks in various areas around the world. That's our last formal event of the year. I am actually going to be hosting an event out of the Friday Center, but I'll come and talk to you about that next week or the week following.
So. Awesome. Max Orr, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you, Aaron,
for being
you.
I'm grateful for you.
Thanksgiving and Oh the Humanities, we're thankful for you.
Humanities.unc.edu for more information on Carolina Public Humanities.